The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 229 for Monday, December 7th, 2009.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. As my friend John Braun there said, it's Monday, and so we're here. That's kind of how we roll. I'm Dave Hamilton, here in Durham, New Hampshire.
You, John Braun, that's Fairfield, right. Or John F. Braun, if you prefer, or I prefer, not always. in Fairfield, Connecticut.
And so you did you get snow this past weekend, John?
We were going to talk about the winter wonderland. Not really. I would call it. So I'm close to the coast here, which several times gets blessed with less
absolutely
hazardous or severe weather than the central Connecticut,
sure,
or states like you. So, anyways, no, it was pretty much coast. It was Saturday was slushing, okay, is what I'll call it, but it gets cooler as it works its way up to
definitely
at least from what I saw on the maps. Definitely. So, anyways, it was slushing, and it was a good thing that it slushed because, you know, we like a lot of communities, we have leaf pickup.
Right.
If you put them in. And you know, I've been thinking about doing it and really seriously considering doing it and really, you know, getting down to the wire. And I did, because after that night where it did that, the next day, it was a bit chilly out. But, you know, I have a small yard. So sure. That was leaf rake and leaf bag in the paper bags day. And I'm feeling it a little bit now.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still old school. I use a rake and, you know, manually bag it. It's exercise. Come on.
It's good exercise.
What's with this leaf blower stuff? And
no, I agree. It's actually great exercise doing that.
So, but you had, I saw you had a improvised gate to,
I had a gig.
Want to comment on that photo.
Yeah. I had a gig Saturday night with a band called Chafed, and I'm actually playing in Manchester, New Hampshire next Saturday night,
Chafed?
The 12th. Chafed. That's right. Okay. They're a good cover band. They're, you know, kind of 60s, 70s, and then lots of kind of 80s and 90s stuff, but they're good. And so I played with them Saturday night, and on my way home, it was snowing, you know, and it snowed all night. And we had maybe, it wasn't a lot of snow, but it was real slushy and
but sort the same
of
thing. It was
slickery
like
heavy.
Was it like wet? It wasn't like, you know, fluffy snow.
No.
It was like kind of wintry mix kind of
right
nastiness.
And yeah, it stuck, okay, to everything. And so, you know, all the trees were really kind of laden down with this stuff. And as I got home, I pulled into my driveway. And as one of my Twitter followers who saw the picture said, I had a new gated driveway because I had this tree down. It hadn't broken. It was, you know, it just needed to. It was a manual operation tree gate. So I had to get out and shake the tree until the snow fell off of it enough and it stood itself back up. And I drove on in. So. All right. But speaking of winter wonderlands, we have a winter wonderland of geeky stuff, tips, and questions. So let's get right into it, shall we, John? And we'll go to Steve first. Steve, in the cool stuff found category, says, following on from the add-on option key for goodies conversation, I came across this the other day, although it's not really related. Excellent. When you have tabs enabled in Safari and have multiple tabs open in a window, if you click and drag on one of the tabs, it pulls it from the tab bar and makes a mini version at the mouse pointer. If you then drag it over another Safari window, it will change the icon at the mouse pointer to a tab, and you can drop it here, or you can drop it anywhere else outside of Safari, and it creates a new window. Not earth-shattering, but it's there. And thank you very much, Steve. Yeah, this is cool. This is something I use quite a bit. You can rearrange the tabs in one tab window doing the same thing. Yeah, you kind of pull the tab out, and just like Steve says, it pops up its own kind of in its own little right at the mouse pointer. It's like a mini version of the window, just like you described. And if you don't drop it in a window, it creates its own window. And like you said, if you drop it in a window, even the existing one, you can put it in the tab bar and it'll add a tab.
Right.
So
kind of freaked me out, man.
Yeah, it's cool though.
When I did it though, because I'm normally open tab, close tab window type of guy. I don't really mess with the menu bar. So I was kind of shocked when I saw this little mini version, but it was very, you know, elegant because it kind of gave you a feeling of what's happening. And then dragging it outside, opening a new window, I guess that's expected.
Yeah. So, yeah, it does just what you'd think it would. Yep. So cool. Thanks, Steve. Shall we move on to Alex? This was something I did not know existed, which is what I love.
Well, this was part of a...
Yeah.
Can you reverb me, brother?
You are reverbed up.
This is part of the Geek Challenge.
Of course it is.
And an answer, and an excellent answer. And actually, Alex answered another question, the one we have about SNMP in the future. I believe he chimed in on that. But anyways, go on to Alex.
Okay. So Alex says, in order to see what frequency, voltage, and temperature your CPU is running at, I use a piece of software called Coolbook at coolbook.se. If you just want to see the clock speed and don't want to change it, you can use this software for free. However, if you register for the fair price of $10, you can set the clock speed and voltage of your CPU. I highly recommend doing this undervolting procedure. I've had as much or more success than the example that's provided on the website. Undervolting is a process that's very simple to use and makes a huge difference in my computing experience. I think it'd be great if you discussed this on the show. And of course, we are. So thank you, Alex. And John, I know you've installed this, but I'll speak to what this purports to do, and you can kind of tell us what you saw. But the idea is, by undervolting it, and there are some examples on the website, and I think some guidelines to use, you can actually keep your processor running at the same speed, but run it cooler, which of course reduces fan noise. It reduces power consumption, which extends battery life. And of course, because you're not running it as hot, it reduces heat. Now, there's probably some questions as to, well, why wouldn't Apple do this? Right. So go ahead, John. You've installed this so far, right?
I've installed it and I've looked at what it says. So one thing that it says, and this is a feature that you have in a lot of modern processors, even though, for example, my MacBook Pro has a 2.6 gigahertz dual core, Intel was wise, at least in the... I think this feature may be in the desktops, but not to that extent, because the thing is, with a portable, your clear goal is to consume as little power as possible.
Sure.
Without inconveniencing the user. So what the processor will do is, if whatever triggers cause this, it'll not run at the full speed. Now, I'm looking right now, I'm seeing running a Coolbook controller, I see 2600, but then I see it going to 14, 2000, 1200, 14, and I think what happens is the processor is constantly doing this of its own accord, or maybe with a little direction from the OS. Now, so that being said, so this tool absolutely shows, as far as I can tell, because every processor has a way, obviously, you know, if you're a real low level geek, to read these fundamental things. And I think these guys have cracked, you know, the whatever developer API Intel offers to do that. Now, my only concern is that monkeying with these values without knowledge of the OS may lead to some unexpected behavior.
It would stand
may.
To reason.
Let's capitalize, maybe, capital M-A-Y.
May, that's right. Yeah. Now, of course, Alex has reported no problems, and the authors of the software have reported no problems. But... sure looks interesting. I proceed with caution. Proceed under warranty is, you know, another one of those things
I
would do.
I guess the only thing I would say is things that are, and maybe, so I'll speculate, that things that are timing dependent may get upset if this is happening and the processor is not doing what they expect. So maybe music stuff or anything where you're communicating with another device. It's hard to say.
You're not changing the bus speed, though, right? You're only changing the voltage.
The processor.
Yeah, so...
Well, the voltage to the processor, and I guess, you know, maybe it's transparent. Maybe if you change the voltage, it advertises, you know, to anybody that cares, a lower speed. Because it's kind of circumventing, you know, the OS in a sense, So I have no, it's just a gut feel that some apps may get upset about this, but no reports are, well, I haven't run it a lot, so I'll,
all right,
cool. Well, I haven't run it in the modification mode, so, we'll give it a whirl.
Yeah, we'll check it out. All right, cool. Thanks, Alex. On to Dennis. Dennis says, I'm six months new to the Mac, and oh, you guys, many thanks. I've learned a lot from your show. Let's see. It's funny. I got to find where we are here. During show 225, someone asked about screen sharing with his laptop lid closed. I have used an application called Insomnia X, which does exactly what he is looking for. I sure hope this helps him out. Here's the link. And sure enough, it's at we'll put the link in the show notes. I'm not going to bother to spell that out. But Insomnia X does exactly what we had a listener who wanted to run MacBook closed without it connected to an external monitor, but wanted to be able to have the machine stay awake. And in fact, that's what Insomnia X does. So go ahead and check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes, and it should be right here in the enhanced version for you. Mm-hmm. Anything to add about that, John, or no?
I could start freaking out again that you're circumventing this feature. But if it works to you, I mean, your machine may run hotter and stuff like that. But
I've talked to a lot of people, because I agree with you, John. It stands to reason that the machine's going to run too hot. But I've talked to people that run in this mode a lot, and every one of them has said, yeah, my guess is it runs hotter, but I've never had a problem. It's never, shut down. It's never overheated. I think the machine really is built to run in closed lid mode with a monitor attached is the assumption, because why else would you want to do it? But as we've answered, there are reasons to want to do it, especially if you're running it as a server.
Yeah, or I think you want to the only thing I would suggest, and I think both you and I do this, is I have a laptop elevator, if you will, device that allows the machine to be elevated so that you have airflow all around the machine.
Right.
I would say what a lot of people probably do is put their laptop on, hopefully not a nice insulator, like a blanket or a bed or something like that, or whatever. I mean, a wooden table is probably better, but anything where there's not a clear path for it to dissipate heat underneath it may not be the best place if you're going to be running it in one of these modes where it's going to be, I think, expecting or hoping for a way to get rid of all that heat.
Right.
We can talk afterwards, Dave, but I have a stand that I use. I don't have it in front of me. I forget the exact model, and I think you have one too.
Yeah.
So I think we'd agree that you want to, if you're going to run your portable, heavy duty, you probably want to raise it up.
I agree. Yeah. Get airflow all the way around it, just like you said. Yep. Our first sponsor for this show is Smile on My Mac. They are available on the web at smileonmymac.com. And we're talking about Disk Label. They have a bunch of different software that they produce there at Smile on My Mac. Disk Label is a program that lets you create, print, and even share CD labels that you could put right on your CDs, jewel case inserts that you could put inside those CD jewel cases, and DVD covers that fit into kind of the taller DVD style cases that we all have come to know and love for the larger format stuff. You can print, you can take your iTunes track information right from iTunes, pull it in to Disk Label, and print that. You can pull, album art, or you could make your own art. They've got all sorts of templates. If you've created an iDVD, say you've pulled all your photos in for Christmas time, right, or whatever holiday it is you care to send someone a gift, maybe of a great gift for the grandparents, right? You've got all the pictures that you've taken all year long. You sit down at your Mac, you pull them into, you do your best Ken Burns stuff with iDVD, you make this cool little thing. Now, you've got great content on the DVD, but you want to have a label that looks good. So you go into Disk Label, you make the label for the DVD itself, you print that on your printer, you slap that on the label, on the DVD, then you want to create one of those DVD covers. So you go in, you maybe pull some pictures from iPhoto, you put them all together, you build a really nice label, and you print it all using Disk Label from Smile on My Mac. Of course, it's available for free for a trial. You can download it right from their website, and then when you're ready to buy it, it's $35.95. So again, this is from smileonmymac.com, Disk Label version 6. John, last week,
yes,
we opened up a can of worms.
And we're going to close it.
Well, we may close it. It'll probably open up again. You know how we are. our listeners like to keep us engaged on stuff like this. So, and engaged you were. We had a discussion last week about how to monitor how much bandwidth you're using. And we talk about a lot of geeky things on this show, and sometimes we go pretty geeky. You know, we peg the geek meter, as it were. And sometimes we get no feedback about this geeky stuff, and we just sort of like, okay, well, that was fun to talk about, but we'll leave it alone and we'll kind of move on to something else. And I really thought this was going to be one of those topics, but it wasn't.
Really?
Yeah, well, I did, because it's sort of like, well, who really cares about this? You know, but apparently the answer is lots of people. And I can see why, right? For those of you who are thinking, gosh, who really cares about this? The people that care are anyone who has what is maybe either not an unlimited cable connection or a pseudo unlimited cable modem or DSL connection, where your bandwidth really is limited in some way, shape, or form. And you want to have some idea of the type and amount of bandwidth that you're pushing from month to month. So that's really where the interest comes from. And so we've opened up this can of worms, and we talked about a couple of different ways, but really reached out to you folks. And then also John and I did some research this week, John more than me. And so, John, why don't you take it away with some of the stuff you found, and then we'll go through some of the stuff our listeners found, too.
Okay, and I'll give credit because I believe Alex, who we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. also gave me this tip. So one piece of software that I found but didn't think worked under Snow Leopard or Leopard, those are the two OSs I'm running, is something called Airport Monitor Utility at trulycertifiable.com/products. You can find it. And when I typed in, so what would happen, and I guess I'm a bit rusty on SNMP, but at one point when it asked for the IP address of my time capsule, which it is compatible with, it said password. And I'm like, oh, you must want the password to use to administer the base station.
I'm going to interrupt you here, John, and I'm sorry to do this.
Well, you did, but go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to make sure that the purpose of this software is to talk to your airport base station and get bandwidth statistics from it, which will give you a better sense of how, a more accurate sense of how much bandwidth you're pushing in and out of your entire network, as opposed to just from your Mac. So with that, I will shut my mouth. And as we talk about these different software products, we will differentiate which ones talk about bandwidth from your Mac versus bandwidth from your router, which in this case is your airport router. So go ahead, John.
Yeah. And that's a good clarification.
Yeah.
So this utility will attempt to talk to the airport using SNMP and ask it certain questions about, you know, how much data have you sent over this and this and this. The problem was when I tried this utility quickly before the last show, when it asked for a password, I mistook it asking for my airport password. No, what it was asking for, and this is one mini fist shake at how SNMP is implemented. SNMP is a way, a simple network management protocol, is a way for a computer to talk to network devices and say, hey, you know, tell me this, or it can even instruct it, I believe, to do certain things. The thing is, one core of this is they have a community name that devices belong to, and it's almost always set to public.
By default.
Yes. And that's probably good, but the thing is, when this utility started up, what it was asking for was not the password of the my time capsule, but the password, or it's not even a password. That's the problem I had when I saw this prompt. It's the community name, which for almost any device that you get out of the box will be set to public. Now, of course, you can set that. And oh, my goodness, I have it somewhere.
I've got it. And you can set it on some airport devices. Now, where you go to turn on or turn off SNMP support is in the airport utility. You go to advanced statistics. And then there's an SNMP section on older airport devices. All you get is a checkbox that says enable SNMP, and you can turn that off, of course. If you have a newer airport device that allows the setting of the community name, it will tell you community name, and then right in there it says public. And of course, you can change that and then update your base station to reflect that.
Yep. So before, when I tried to run this, it would say timeout. Sorry, you know, I don't know what device you're. Now, the only key was I had to enter the IP address, which for some is non-intuitive. The IP address of the router is, if you're on any host machine on the network, In this case, I set it to a 172 subnet.
Okay.
So that's the only, probably the hardest part of this is figuring out the IP address and getting the password or community name right. So in my case, I put 172.16.1.1, and then it ran beautifully. It shows a system list that has the name of the device, uptime. And then here's the part that applies to both this and something we're going to talk about in a few minutes. Interfaces. Now, here's the part that gets kind of weird. This utility will talk to the device and say, hey, if you have an interface, which is a port, I would say, or a channel to communicate information, whether it be wired or wireless, and tell me, you know, what it's been up to. Now, the problem is the name of these ports. Now, for example, I'm connecting to my time capsule. It's a couple of years old. There are 6 ports on here, or interfaces in the interfaces tab. Bridge 0, VLAN 1, GEC 0, LO 0. I'm going to assume that's loopback. WLAN 0. Ooh, that one sounds good. And MV 0. Now, I'm going to use my geek gut here, Dave, and maybe you'll concur with me, is that WLAN 0 is probably the connection that's going out to the internet at large and the interface that if anybody reported the throughput of data on this, it would be that interface. So it's kind of you and I chatted earlier today. That's my newbie, because I haven't done a heck of a lot of work in this area, but if you have a follow-up. But I think WLAN 0 will probably tell you the number that you're looking for as far as total bandwidth consumed. Since reboot, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if the software is not logging anything, then the device will only remember what it's seen since the last reboot or last reset of any type. But I think you're right with the airport devices. I would presume that to be a reboot. Yeah.
Okay, and it says out octets. You know, they use the
yeah.
Sorry, newbies. Octet. Just remember, oct means 8. Octet is probably a byte.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, so part one of that question is that's how you get that utility, which I questioned whether it was working properly or even worked under Snow Leopard, and it does. So yeah. It is a utility. It's a 30-day trial, but I think it gives you a very, very good summary. Now, on the one end, that's cool. On the other end, I was searching, and Dave, I found something. Just love the open source community.
Yeah.
There is a little open source thing on SourceForge called SNMP status. This is bare bones, folks, but it will. Now, the only thing that threw me is when I launched it, I'm like, did it run? I don't see anything happening. Mm. It puts itself in your menu bar, but basically what it shows you is a very little dialogue. Amongst the selections are interface and then units to represent throughput. So this tool, from what I can see, and I don't know if you tried it, Dave, but its purpose is pretty much to say, here's the interface, here's how much data I saw running across it. You figure it out.
Okay. So
it's kind of arcane, but it's a SourceForge thing. It's totally free. You know, it's, I think, worth the money you pay for it, which is nothing.
Right.
And it will report these statistics similar. So Airport Monitor Utility is a very nice way of doing this. SNMP status is, if you want to dig around in the dirt, you know,
got it.
So you get what you pay for, I think, in this case.
Yeah,
and there may be more. We're moving on here.
Yeah, there are more. I wanted to quickly talk about how to find the address of your router, and the best way to do it for most of you is going to be to go into System Preferences, go to Network, and then click on your main active network connection. So it's either going to be, for most of you, either built-in Ethernet if you're plugged in, or built-in airport, or just
it'll
simply airport. Yeah, that's right. It'll have a green light and it'll be at the top of the list. And if you click on that, it should give you status connected, and then it'll give you a couple of addresses. And the one you're looking for is labeled router. That's the one that that your computer is talking to get out onto the internet. All the traffic that it's going to send to and from the internet is going to go via that router device. So that's the way to find the IP address. Then just, you know, write it down, or you know, if you can get the two windows open, just type it in and that should work.
It should be. I've usually seen it at you know, like I have set up 1.1 or
yeah,
you know, usually a low address, sometimes high, I guess.
It could be anything. I have mine set to .10 here, and I'm not going to go into why. I will,
okay,
because everybody's going to wonder. because I had, when we were moving up here, I had a router at home and a router here, router at my old home and a router here, and I needed to set them up simultaneously. And so it was like, well, it's going to, it was a long story. It's convoluted, but it made sense to assign but this 1.10.
They didn't fight.
Yeah, so they didn't fight. Exactly. I had I had two things. I had an old Linux box that was .1.1, and it was like, whatever. So so that's that. But it can be anything. By default, it's going to be, you know, whatever your network range is, .1, if you want to guess at it. All right. And then along these same lines, we got an email from Steve. And Steve says, regarding MacGeekGab 228 podcast, take a look at NetMonitor. Works fine on my MacBook Pro. I've been using it for a long time, mostly for a menu bar display of up and download, but it has a reporting utility that's very flexible. NetMonitor traffic log. Okay. I talked to the developer about this, or I emailed back and forth with him today. And NetMonitor is an interesting piece of software. It monitors only your Mac. It does not use SNMP to talk to other routers or anything like that. But
So a machine needs each machine needs.
Yes.
Monitor.
Yes.
Okay.
But what it can do is it can talk to it can filter its reports and its results using a thing called NetMonitor Sidekick. And what that does is lets you say, oh, only show me the stuff that's passing via my router. Right. So don't tell me if I'm, you know, don't tell me about the bandwidth of me file sharing with John's computer. If he's local to my network, only tell me about the stuff that's going, excuse me, to and from the internet. It's not perfect, but it is something else to monkey with. So it's another little toy is really
that addresses our issue before, which is how do you separate the traffic
from
local versus to the net? So that's excellent.
Mm hmm. And then another Steve, at least I think it's another Steve, but it could be the same Steve, on Twitter alerted us to a piece of software called Lithium that's going to do exactly what we want. And then some. It does tons of stuff, but it's available at lithium5.com. It's $129. So it's clearly not in the realm of free and cheap, but it definitely gets the job done. And then some. It's a full featured SNMP monitoring network tool that will do all of this. So,
and I look, so they have a Mac client, iPhone, web browser.
Yeah.
So this sounds like to me, that price, it's not for the newbie.
No, but it's not a bad, considering what they're doing.
But for a person who is managing maybe a small household or educational or whatever network, especially, you know, if you're concerned, you know, a household network with, you know, different people or whatever type of network. I think it's good that it, you know, lets you get it down to that level.
Yeah.
But I like the iPhone client. It looks really nice.
Yeah. I'm going to check it out. I'm going to Austin tomorrow, so I didn't want to download it and start my trial or anything, but I've got it on my list of things to mess with because I think it'll be a cool thing. Yeah.
And I'm thinking too is, you know, your kids are, you were pointing out they're getting to that age. So, you got to put the hammer down.
That's right. That's right.
You got to look at what they're doing. You got to spy on them.
I need to spy on my children. That's right. Yeah. Parenting isn't enough here, folks. We need to, need to spy on our children. All right.
Oh, before that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So last week, we
had a little thing due to. So we had, if you recall, folks, I think I ranted a little bit about why is Comcast and actually a follow. So Comcast, after our rant, announced, isn't this awesome that they're rolling out a bandwidth metering service?
That's right. It was almost instant.
It was no. I think it was after you and I had this discussion, Dave.
Well, they said it was coming months ago, but they didn't indicate when.
Well, we fueled them on that.
That's right. And so now they've announced that January 5th is when every Comcast customer will be able to log into their support account and see the bandwidth that they've used for at least the previous 2 months and the bandwidth that they're using or they've used thus far in the current month. It's it's almost real time. It's 3 hours delayed, is what they're saying, or right. at least up to, you know, 3 hours delayed.
But a little follow up is, I remember one of the emails that I read through in prepping was Rogers. Apparently someone pointed out to us that Rogers. So I think the person who was having the bandwidth issues
right.
said, I got Rogers. One reader or listener,
Ben wrote in,
said Rogers does apparently, if you register with them, and you don't have to, I don't think any of these guys, I do online billing with, you know,
sure. With your cable company.
And
right.
you probably do too.
I do.
And they show me a lot of things. I don't think I haven't looked, but so the suggestion to me was Rogers, if you register online, either for bill pay or whatever, you can see some indication of your bandwidth. So, you know, it seems like the providers pretty much have to do this if they're going to nail you if you go over it. So,
Yep. It's good. So, so January 5th, you've got less than a month before you'll be able to see what, at least what Comcast does. I'm looking forward to that because I'm already tracking my bandwidth usage.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to seeing how it matches up because that's going to be very interesting to me.
Yeah. So until then, I would say, you know, hop on the local neighborhood unsecured Linksys base station.
That's right. Hey, I found one out there. Yep. That's right.
Well, Dave, you and I, well, we both got, and actually I'm pretty impressed. We'll have a follow-up, but, you know, both you and I got the newer Wi-Fi units, and I got to say I'm very impressed with the new software
Much better.
The unit itself, and yes, there is at least one. I'm shocked, probably in a casual inspection on the lower floor of my house, I saw about 12 to 15 base stations. Only one was unsecured and called Linksys. Everybody else had at least some sort of security applied.
Yeah, it's
the word is getting out.
Well, and also the software that comes with these base stations now is walking people through the process of securing them as part
Excellent.
Of the setup, which is good. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You know, there's times when I don't think it's good, like when I'm, you know, need to get online.
But we're going to we're going to dig into this because I think it's something you and I have looked at before. And I think we got to, you know, they've definitely improved their hardware and software. So, stay tuned.
Our second sponsor for the show is Circus Ponies. You've heard us, if you've listened to the show for any length of time, you've heard us talk about them before, and we're going to talk about them again. Circus Ponies makes a product called Notebook. Notebook version 3.0 is what they're up to. Notebook is an interesting application. It allows you to take a series of unrelated files or even just snippets of information relating to a topic, and it's a topic or a collection of your choosing, and then you can pull them all together. Now, when you start the software, it's a little bit daunting because you just see a blank, you know, white or yellow line notebook where you've got, you know, the little lines, and you can start typing there and certainly type, and you can tab in and get a hierarchical kind of thing going on. But the cool part, the real strength is when you start pulling in other bits of data like PDFs or emails or, you know, Word documents or whatever, and associating them all together with this one collection or one notebook, as it were. And then you can search, once you've built this thing and you've added to it over time, you can search the notebook. And the cool thing is you can search based on what you remember about the data. So if you say, oh, yeah, I know I put that in here last Tuesday, show me everything that came in last Tuesday, and boom, it'll come right up with that. Or, you know, I use this keyword, so show me everything with this keyword. And the cool thing is, if you've got multiple notebooks, you can actually use what they call Multidex, which is their search engine that goes across all of your notebooks at once. You can say, show me everything that I did last Tuesday, and it'll go through and show you that. This is available at circusponies.com. Notebook version 3.0. It is, of course, available free download. You get a free trial, and then a standard license is just $50. Well, even less, $49.95. And when you're ready to buy, you just go to circusponies.com and you can buy it there. But I highly recommend going and downloading the free trial first. Get it into your workflow. Use some of their pre-built templates so it's not so daunting. They've got some example templates that that you can modify and use, and that's a much better way of getting your feet wet with it. And all that's available at circusponies.com. And now, John, it's time to move on to the questions. Michael asks, I love the show. I have a lot to learn from others' questions, and I'm glad to hear that. John and I are both very glad to hear that. But I have my own. Is there a way to sort my book? I'll start this again, and maybe this time I'll talk.
No, you could say bookmark.
Yeah, that's what it is. But I just my mouth wasn't going in the right direction. Is there a way to sort my bookmarks in Safari without having to drag them up or down? I would like them to be alphabetical order within each tab. I know I could do this in IE under Windows XP. Thanks for any insight. Okay, so the answer is
no.
But.
No, but, not within Safari.
But.
The answer within Safari is no. Will you agree with me?
I'll agree with you with a but at the end. Because there's there's two ways to do this that I've found. And actually, there's more than two ways. But
because I've used IE and others. Yeah. And to me, that's such a simple feature. I thought right-click. I'm like, where is it? So I was rather upset by this question. Go on.
So there's two ways to do it. One, I found an article at Mac OS 10 Hints that talks about this, which is actually pretty cool. You drag your bookmark folder. You take, any one of the tabs. The tabs are all different folders, right? You go into your edit bookmarks mode. You drag the folder out to the Finder, and the Finder will automatically sort all the bookmarks in the folder, and then you drag them back in, and bam, they're all sorted. So that's one way to do it. It doesn't automatically keep them sorted, and it's not all that elegant, but it has, it's its own little simple elegance in that you don't need any third-party software. However, mentioning third-party software brings in the elegant solution with a piece of software called Saft, S-A-F as in Foxtrot, T. And what that will do is exactly what you're looking for, John. It will allow you to do sorting from inside Safari. Right there when you're editing your bookmarks. So that's why it's a no, but.
Oh.
So there you go.
So maybe that's a Safari plugin or internet plugin that we've been kind of kicking around.
It's a Safari add-on.
Or add-on.
Which is different than a plugin. I believe it's not a browser plugin.
We'll dig into that.
Yeah, it's not a browser plugin, but it's a,
But to me, that's kind of a glaring omission. Now, I appreciate the cleverness of dragging the folder out and resorting and bringing it back, but that's not the right way to do it.
Yeah, it's right, exactly. Yeah, so Saft is the thing I would go on and recommend. So,
yep.
Dare we? Can we talk more about this so that we don't have to open the can of worms that is David's question, or is it time to open the can of worms that is David's question?
I don't like that. No, that can. We got to keep that can closed.
No, we've talked about it. Okay.
No.
Yep. David says, well, he's down in New Zealand. It's okay.
Oh, all right.
All right, good. hi, I was hoping you could help with Wi-Fi speed issues on my iPhone. Oh, no, sorry, we can't. Anyway, at home, I use a 2 terabyte time capsule, which gives me great speed with my MacBooks at home. However, for some reason, my first-gen iPhone can only get about 300 kilobits per second download and 600 upload. I also have an AirPort Express N series and an old AirPort Extreme G series that I've been using up until I got the time capsule. I've tried them all with the same results. The only difference I can make is if I configure the AirPort to be G only, which gives me about 500 upload and download unchanged. 500 download and the upload remains unchanged. The AirPorts get their connection via a D-Link ADSL2 modem. It's not my iPhone because at work and on other networks, I get 3,000 kilobits per second. You should get even more. I've searched the net and found loads of people with the same problem, but none of the suggestions have made a difference. Okay, so I have seen this issue here, John, at my house. Now, the interesting thing is I have the first generation time capsule, which only has the one radio in it. So I actually have the time capsule using 5 gigahertz only at my house. Right. I do have an older Snow AirPort base station, and occasionally I'll get this weird thing where my iPhone and my TiVo don't want to talk all that fast. And I have to reset my airport base station. Then it comes back around, and I've always sort of written it off as, well, you know, it's house and, you know, interference and blah, microwave oven and blah, blah, blah. And that's just life, you know, and it doesn't happen all that often. So it doesn't drive me crazy. But it sounds like for David, it's happening all the time. So, you know, there's these, you know, he says he's changed the channel, I think, right? Or am I confusing that? No, maybe he hasn't changed the channel. But that would be one thing to try. But I'm guessing he's already tried that, but maybe not.
No, I know we saw another question.
Yeah, there was another question.
Channel. Yeah, I think I think what you're leaning towards is that it's in environmental.
I think so. You know, what I would do actually is I would get that air radar software that we've talked about. That's kind of the iStumbler replacement, and you fire that up on your Mac, and that will list all of the networks that are available that it can see, and look for the ones that are in that channel 1 to 11 range, which is the G or B range. And actually, I forget if New Zealand goes up to 14. It might go up to 14 down there. Here in the States, we're 1 to 11, but I think it's possible you go up to 14. So take a look and see if you've got other stuff in that range. If you do, make it so that, you know, if you've got a lot of stuff between 1 and 6, set yours up to 11. Conversely, if everything else is up there, set it down. If there's stuff all over the place, find the connection with the weakest signal and set your... you know, set your network in that range.
So you can in turn traumatize them.
Well, hopefully your signal is just as weak to them as theirs is to you, yeah. Right? I mean, that would be the presumption.
No, but it definitely sounds, the more I think about it, is, you know, just if it sounds like he's not in the sticks. He's near other people with other devices, in which case, yeah, you're playing this game constantly.
Yeah, well, unless you've got a 2.4 gigahertz cordless phone, which could get in the way of this. So that's...
Well, you know, that's kind of 2.4, and I think even 5. I mean, the thing is, yeah, they pick these ranges for a reason. They're meant for, you know, consumer,
right,
and maybe business and other uses. But yeah, 2.4 is kind of the dumping ground for a lot of things, including, yeah, I mean, microwave ovens are the the one worst thing. I mean, they really mess things up. But you know, yeah, as you pointed out, they have cordless phones and, you know, other probably handheld radios and stuff like that. So, yeah, you need, I think, the conclusion is you need a tool that can adequately profile what radios are around you and what frequency and what strength. And then you just do, you know, a little... you know, back of the napkin thing and figure out where should I be that is the least,
right,
is not the worst place to be.
That's right. That's right. And if you're doing stuff on the back of the napkin, it all has to be in orders of magnitude. I think that's an unwritten rule. Correct, John?
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
I don't know. Just say, you know, back of the napkin. It's always good for orders of magnitude. All right.
Well, if you're, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just throwing it around.
Yeah. Go.
Moving on to Brad. Brad writes, the name is Larkin, Brad Larkin, and I have a question about formatting USB drives. I recently bought a 1 terabyte iOmega desktop USB drive, and when trying to format it, I got an error saying that disk utility had failed. The drive came as a PC FAT32 drive, but iOmega claims it will work on Macs. Every time I try to format, disk utility fails. The solution I found on the internet was that Disk Utility has trouble with USB drives being formatted with the option Master Boot Record selected. Once you change that to GUID, all is well with the world and everything formats just fine. Just wondering why this is. I put a call into a friend at Apple to see what he said, but I haven't heard back as of yet. All right. Okay, so I have seen this before, and I think we've even talked about this on the show before, John. It's an issue with Master Boot Record, I believe Disk Utility, and partitions larger than 500 gigabytes. I don't believe that if you have the drive set up using the MBR partition scheme, that you can format larger than 500 gigabytes with an HFS Plus partition type. So the trick is, you change the partition scheme of the drive to GUID, and then you can make an HFS Plus partition of your full 1 terabyte and go. My guess is this drive came formatted with 2 500 gigabyte or thereabouts partitions of FAT32, and that's why your Mac was okay with it. But as soon as you tried to combine them into one partition of a different type, it failed on you. That's what I've seen with other drives. So, but this brings up a good question. And John, I know you're raring to go on this. So the question is, while we're talking, you know, FAT32 and HFS Plus, and at the same time we're talking master boot record and, you know, GUID and Apple partition map, and what the heck's going on?
I'm very confused and scared by what you said, so I'm going to take a nap and be back.
Good. Excellent.
That's when you click on it. When you click. Hello.
I was giving you napping music.
All right. So when you select a drive, there's a partition tab. There is also
in disk utility. This is
in disk utility.
Thank
when you.
When you
click on a drive, not the partition under the drive, but the drive itself, there's a partition tab. If you click on the drive itself and you want to partition it, there is then an options screen. That is the partition type. And I think part of the confusion here is that you can create mixtures or partition types and format types. So let's be very clear. At the highest level, a drive has to have a partition type. And as we've talked about, there are three main ones that at least Apple's disk utility.
I gotta whoop. We can't.
Go.
No, I think the terminology that we to stick with Apple's terminology on this, there is a partition scheme.
Okay.
There is a partition type, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's a format to the drive. And I guess partition type and format are the same thing.
Well, I know I'm looking Apple here, and I see the button, the options button. When you float over it, it says partition map scheme.
Scheme. Okay. So the scheme is the very top level thing. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Good. Okay.
What so I can see here.
Yeah.
So when you select that and you click on the options button,
yep,
there are three choices as we've talked about. There's the MBR,
which is most common on Windows machines,
right? Master boot record. There's GUID, which is pretty much Intel Mac. And then there is, what is the third type?
Apple partition map.
There we go. And I even made a note about that. So those are the three types that at least disk utility. Now, of course, there's many more, but we're not going to talk about that.
Sure.
That's a whole show in itself. Then the other, so just to be clear, when we say MBR, GUID, or Apple partition map, which we really don't, because that I think is pretty exclusive to the older PowerPC Macs, right?
That's right.
Dave?
Yeah, which I and
though
I run
they work.
Those, so yeah.
So I wouldn't format a new drive with Apple partition map, but if you have an older one, it should be readable. But then the format type. So this is the other tab that you see when you click on a drive. Usually not the top level drive, but the, if you click on, the top level drive and you say erase, then you have the volume format. And this is a little different. This is where you can either select macOS extended journaled, which I would say for the most part, for most Mac users,
that's
what
one
you want to pick. But there are some others. Like, for example, I'm looking here and I see MS-DOS FAT, and on this machine I don't have it installed, but I think if you have it installed, there's something called NTFS 3G that will actually let you on a Mac format NTFS drives as a volume format. Now in that case, I think MBR, it being pretty much,
yeah,
NTFS being a Windows format, MBR would probably be the partition mapping scheme or type. So just wanted to dig into that because it can get confusing, because you can create combinations of those that result in tragedy.
Yeah, the one thing and we have talked about this before, but the one thing that I remember learning the last time we kind of walked down this path was that Apple partition map is not exclusive to the older PowerPC machines. In fact, I believe what we learned last time was that Apple partition map drives will boot the newer Intel Macs, and that's how CDs and DVDs that are built to boot either older and newer Macs, you know, Intel and non-Intel Macs. So if you still run in a mixed environment,
good advice.
Setting up an Apple partition map is not is probably your best bet if you're going to want to boot from it. If you don't care to boot from it, then it doesn't matter, right? But if you want to boot from it, then, you know, think about that ahead of time. That because the thing is, just like changing the drive form, although you can change the drives, the form, the you can change the partition size, assuming you have the room to do so, non-destructively nowadays. There is software out there, actually some of it's built right into Mac OS X, though it's not obvious, that will allow you to change the partition size without destroying your data. However, if you want to change the format type, as John explained, Mac OS X Extended, FAT, NTFS, or any of the above, you have to destroy the data. And going one up from that, if you want to change the partition scheme, MBR, GUID, Apple partition map, you have to destroy your partitions to do that. Or your partitions to do that. So, you know, choose wisely and carefully. So as John said, I think for most people that are running one Mac and it's a newer Mac, GUID, that is the way to go. But if you do have a collection of Macs and some of them are older and you might want to use this drive to boot from them one day, Apple partition map might be your best bet. All right.
And I've been through this recently because actually I got a product which I'll tell you about later.
Okay. But,
it's an external drive that uses a new wireless technology. But
oh, cool.
The documentation, I'll give you a hint, ultra wideband or wireless USB.
Oh, cool.
It's kind of cool, but they shipped the drive to me with NTFS. And they said, basically in the documentation, they said, well, yeah, if you got a Mac, then reformat it. And I'm like, oh, man. Why are you doing this to me?
Oh, I can't wait to hear more about this. That's a nice little teaser. That's good.
Yeah, I thought I've been getting, you know, Dave, I don't know about you. I mean, it's the holidays and all, but I'm making boxes pretty much every day.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
Everybody, I mean, from Mac Observer. I don't know what's in that box. And, you know, it's Mac Observer Clause.
That's right. all right.
Moving on.
Yeah, we can move on. We'll go on to Greg, because Greg has, this is a good one.
It's easy and hard.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, John, Dave, and Pete. I have a question. I recently upgraded to Leopard, and the top menu is kind of like on the screen is like semi-transparent now. And is there any way to get that to white? Because it kind of shows through to the blue background, and it's kind of like this ugly gray. Is there any way to get it white? I mean, I didn't really want to tangle around in the terminal or anything, but if there's some easy way to do that, or it's just kind of like maybe something that, you know, MC Hammer don't touch, or what is it?
Don't touch it.
Can't touch this. Okay. Okay, thanks.
Sound effects and everything. So that's fantastic. All right.
Wow.
You want to, there's two ways to do this depending on your operating system. He asked about Leopard. So we will answer that first, and then we'll talk about how to do it in Snow Leopard, because that has changed.
I'm guessing Greg is a student.
All right.
Perhaps not. Yeah. Maybe he's just lives in a hopping area. But anyways, Snow Leopard, this is easy. And you know,
we said
we
were going to do Leopard first, though, because that's what Greg asked.
What?
And plus, that's what I just said. So, you know, I figure we'll follow the path, right?
I'm reading.
I know you're reading. You're not listening, though.
All right. So the problem is that it turned up in Leopard, and I noticed this, and you noticed this, Dave. And
sure.
I found it freaking annoying. I'm sorry. It's like you're disturbing my, you know, solid menu bar path there. So I guess,
Greg feels the same way.
Yeah. So I guess, you found, OS X Hints has a nice little ditty on this.
They do. And we'll link to that. And it does, unfortunately for Greg, involve some terminal trickery, and it's really not that, it's not all that straightforward. I mean, I think it's one command, but it's a very long and convoluted command. The good news is, there's also a piece of software called Menu Bar Tint from manytricks.com, and there'll be a link in the show notes for that, that allows you to muck with this, and actually you can get your shading back and all that. The terminal trick just turns it white again, which is different from what you were used to in Tiger. And so this Menu Bar Tint thing will actually turn it back to what you think you want, or what you want versus what you think you want. And so that's definitely the way I'd recommend going. So that's Leopard. You're not able to do it simply and elegantly with Apple software, though it is possible to do it with just the base OS. But you can do it with third party software. So that's answer A. And then John, answer B.
Well, first off, it's bogus. They didn't allow the user to set that.
I agree.
I along with everybody else, I noticed in the view menu, especially, you look at this, you look at the screenshot, there's a little blotch in the view menu. And it's like, what is that? I think I was not the only one that as soon as I, you know, install this OS, I'm like, what's this garbage on the top of the menu bar? What are you doing to me? And somebody thought it'd be cool to make it translucent, but I'm sorry, you know, get off my lawn. I mean, I want my menu bar the way it should be. But the good news is in Snow Leopard, it's easy. You go to System Preferences, Personal, in the Personal category, Desktop and Screensaver, Desktop tab, and there's a checkbox, Translucent Menu Bar. So once you upgrade to Snow Leopard, you can just go in there and shut it off or turn it on if you're into that sort of pain. And there you go.
There you go. All right, one more. Should we do? Let's do Lewis. I like that.
Not Mike.
And we'll save Mike for next time. Yeah, because that's going to be a long and convoluted conversation with Mike.
No, yeah.
All right, we'll do Mike. Fine. We're doing Mike. Here we go.
Whoa,
Mike says, wanting to buy an iPod Touch for my girls for Christmas. This is timely. We should. You're right. I have an iMac iLamp model without USB 2.0. Do I have to have one as the spec state? We are currently using iPod Nanos and Shuffles without any problems, except the warning message about not having a USB 2.0 connection. Thanks for the advice. Love the show. All right. Well, the first thing that we did here, John, was you checked Apple's spec site, and that made it was pretty clear, right?
Pretty much. There's an article titled iPod Touch Not Recognized in iTunes for Mac OS X. And one of the reasons, the heading is check USB connections. And it says iPod Touch requires, not in caps, even though I'm emphasizing it, USB 2.0 to function properly. If you are not sure if your Mac has USB 2, which in this case we're sure it doesn't, refer to the Apple tech specs, try connecting iPod Touch to a different port, blah, 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 blah. So Apple's tech support article in this clearly states iPod Touch requires USB 2.0 to function properly, whatever that means.
That's right.
So that's one side of the coin, Dave. But then I think you found the other side of the coin.
Yeah, I found a forum thread. Actually, I found a couple of forum threads about this. Some were at discussions.apple.com, and then there was one that was a little clearer that was at macrumors.com, forums.macrumors.com, that made it pretty clear. There were people talking about this, and they said, look, yeah, it works, but there's some caveats. Number one, it's slow because it's USB 1.1 versus USB 2.0. So you're
which
not-
is to geek out. USB 1 is 12 megabits per second
maximum.
USB 2 is 480. So you're talking big difference. And yes, it is. I think as you and I can both state, Dave, if we've, you know, as we weaned ourselves from our old machines, it's a big difference.
Oh, yeah.
So I think I can understand the reasoning behind Apple's decision, but moving on. So it's drastic, I would say, you know, orders of magnitude.
That's right.
More. You're right, because 11 to an order of magnitude is 110. This is four times an order. So anyway.
Yeah. That's right.
It's a big deal, the difference in speed. And actually, USB 3 is coming out. And from what I hear, USB 3, you're talking in the gigabit, like 5 gigabit range, if I recall some of the specs.
That's right.
So you're talking, again, another, not quite, but gigabits over a cable. I mean, that's good.
Yeah, it's great.
Not megabits, gigabits. So that's cool for USB 3, which, you know, I consider more, you know, pretty much a, you know, kind of consumer electronic thing. That's an awesome, and I think they're thinking of pumping video or real time or whatever.
Oh,
so
interesting. Huh.
So you found stuff hinting that you could do this?
It's going to work, but here's the thing. They say if it's fully charged, it will sync, but don't try to sync more than, you know, 10 or 15 songs at a time, because it's going to be really slow. And there are some issues where there's a timing thing, and the OS or iTunes perhaps will occasionally time out thinking that the device has gone offline when really the device just hasn't gotten enough data to chime back and say, yep, I'm still here, you know, send me more. So it chances are it's going to work, but as you might expect, it's not going to be the pristine experience. So.
I have a wild and wacky thought, Dave.
Wacky it up.
Does that machine have a FireWire port?
Yeah. Yeah. The iLamp has a FireWire port. Yes.
I'm wondering if someone... Oh, I like the name, actually. You know where I'm going.
Yeah. Is there a FireWire to USB bridge?
Well, FireWire is... Even, you know, basic is 400 megabits,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to speculate, though I don't know if it's out there. And, you know, let us know. I don't need the echo here, but Geek Challenge. Does someone make a FireWire to USB adapter that could allow a pleasant experience for our listener here?
Yeah.
That's the only hardware. Because I was thinking, you could plug a USB 2 hub into the machine, but that's not going to accomplish anything. So I'm thinking, can you get a USB 2 port in this machine? No, but there are other ports. So this is my thought. And actually, you know, I think I've seen some Ethernet to USB gizmos. So I would say to get a pleasant user experience, we'll dig around a bit, and we'll also count on our
listeners,
if you know of anything that would allow someone to enable an older machine to get a USB 2 port via another port, we'd really like to know about it. That would be cool, actually.
Yeah, it would be very cool. All right.
Oh, my gosh. How do you contact us, Dave? I mean, you know, people contact us all the time, but there may be some others who are just, you know, waiting to shake their fist at us or ask an important question. And you know, Dave, I think the place I would start is, you know, email is just always the best place to start.
I think it is. It has taken over. We get more of our comments via email now than we get via the phone.
Really?
Email is sent to feedback@macgeekgab.com. So that's the way to email. Now, you can email text. You can email pictures. You can also email audio. In fact, the audio comment that you heard during, or the audio question that you heard during the show from Greg came in via email. Yep. And he recorded it with the voice memo app on his iPhone and then just emailed it right to us right from there. So,
and you know, I think, Dave, the iPod Touch, which I'm still, you know, I'm waiting, but I believe on your iPod Touch, you can also do an audio memo and send it to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, want to make
feedback
sure
feedback at macgeekgab.com.
Now you could call us, and you could pick up the phone and dial.
Let your fingers do the walking, as it
well,
were.
Well, no, actually, that doesn't happen anymore.
No, it doesn't.
When's the last time you saw a princess phone?
Yeah.
Do you know what a princess?
I do.
You know what,
of course, yeah. I know what a princess phone is. Yeah, that's the old big weapon phone that Ma Bell used to give to you when you signed up for phone service, right?
And if you were a big deal, you had a red one.
That's right. 206-666-GEEK is the phone number, and GEEK is
4335.
You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. You can leave us iTunes comments, and I don't know when you're going to be listening to this show, but if you are and you happen to be in Austin tomorrow night, so this is less than 24 hours from the moment that I'm saying this, I am going to be attending the CapMac meeting there tomorrow night. It starts at 7 p.m. Central. It's at some bar. I don't have the name of it right in front of me, but you can go to capmac.org and it'll tell you all about it. So I as long as my flights are on time and everything's good, then I will.
Yeah, well, you got upgraded. Come on, man.
I did. I got the email today saying that I got the upgrade. So I was happy about that. That's right.
And you're gonna be with the Bob, right?
Bob Levitis is presenting tomorrow night. So yeah, that's great. I'm looking forward to that. So
Dr. Bob, you know, this Twitter thing, I think, is still.
Yeah,
it's out there.
It works. It's a good way to get in touch with us. Yeah. John is
John F. Braun. Dave is
Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete is, and he's not here. He's actually at school, we'll say. He is Pilot Pete, as it were. Mac Geek Gab is our kind of show account, if you will.
And then, the flagship site.
Mac Observer, all at twitter.com. iPhoneAlley.com is a great site. We're chitter chattering here and the music ran out on me.
They're
a great site.
Getting chilly.
Yeah, that's right. They're a great site publishing news and a great podcast all about the iPhone. So run by Michael Johnston. Check it out. Great stuff. And then Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth for the show. The podcast marketplace of our sponsors this month includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, Disc Label from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Blue Bridge from Mikus, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And John, that's it. We're out of here, and I got to get on a plane in almost exactly 12 hours.
Huh.
That's all right. I'll live.
Yeah. And of course you're flying, Dave, which means.
Yeah.
Don't get caught.
Made up.